The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this April 29th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are once again on iTunes. If you were a subscriber on iTunes, you may have noticed we had problems for a few months there. Those are resolved, but you may need to resubscribe. We're under Writers on Writing. We're still and always on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're doing and working and focusing and thinking during these interesting quarantine days. And we are acutely aware of what a difficult time this is for debut novelists to have their novels enter the world. All the book tours, the library events, the bookstore readings, the literary festivals have all been canceled. And there's a burgeoning online community and Zoom events that these authors are appearing on. But in this morning's case, some of these people have spent 14 years or more working on a book, and it's entering into a world that's been a little silenced. And if there was ever a book that we shouldn't be silenced about, it is Valentine. My guest this morning is debut novelist Elizabeth Wetmore. The book is published by HarperCollins. Before devoting herself to writing, Elizabeth variously tended bar, taught English, drove a cab, edited psychology dissertations, painted silos and cooling towers at a petrochemical plant. For a time, she lived in a one-room cabin in the woods outside of Flagstaff, Arizona, while she worked as a classical music announcer. She is a native of West Texas, but lives in Chicago, where she joins me from this morning. Elizabeth is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts, two fellowships from the Illinois Arts Council, as well as a grant from the Barbara Deming Foundation. In addition, she was a Rona Jaffe Scholar in Fiction at Breadloaf and a fellow at the McDowell Colony. In the spring of 2015, she was one of six writers in residence at Hedgebrook. As mentioned, the novel we're talking about is Valentine. Ann Patchett calls it a novel of moral urgency and breathtaking prose. Indeed, it is. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks so much for coming. So I am not being facetious when I say that I can see how the sum of all these jobs added up to becoming a writer. And because we have sort of the luxury of time, I just love to hear sort of the, you know, your path into writing, how you came to it, if you'd been writing all along and taking notes throughout all these jobs all the way along, but just kind of talk about that road into writing.
Yeah. You know, I was a child who loved books, loved reading, and also loved writers. I was one of those kids who not only fell in love with a book, but would fall in love with the person who wrote them. And I never really imagined myself as a writer. I think for a very long time, writers to me seemed like, writing seemed like such a almost a holy profession, I think. But I was a prodigious note taker, and I always kept journals. So I think I probably did not write my first complete short story until I was maybe 25, 26. So.
And I was reading an interview with you a couple of days ago about this experience you had as a cab driver. I think you were a cab driver for like a day. I'll let you tell that story and then I'll ask my question. It's such a great story.
Oh man. Well, I was living in Phoenix. I had just left my first sort of brief disastrous marriage, and was waiting tables. I think that at that particular time, my job was at an IHOP, and it was not paying the bills. So I thought I would pick up a little extra money driving a cab in Phoenix. And, the way it worked then was that I had to spend a day training with an experienced cab driver. So I was assigned to this elderly gentleman who had been driving cab for a very long time and who let me know from the moment I set foot in that cab that he did not approve of a young woman driving cab, that he thought it was a terribly dangerous job. And so this was back in the mid-90s, and that he thought I would better be served by finding any other line of work. So basically we spent the day together. I drove him around. He told me where to go. We picked up cab fares. And interestingly, I remember nothing about the people who got in and out of that cab that day. I remember him so clearly, but I don't remember any of the fares we took. And anyway, as throughout the course of the day, as we were driving around Central Phoenix, he would occasionally direct me to an old strip mall and tell me to just wait in the car while he went in and ran an errand. Or at one point he wanted to go see what, you know, he called his lady friend. And so he left me sitting out in the cab, you know, while he went in to visit her. I never fully knew what his deal was. He seemed like a man who had sort of had a lot of experiences and probably had a pretty rough life. And at the end of the day, and it was a long shift, I think we drove together for about 7 or 8 hours. And at the end of the day, you know, of course he took all the tips because that's how training works. And asked me what I thought about the day. And I told him very firmly that I agreed with him 100% that cab driving was not for me. and we sort of parted ways. So, but I remembered him, you know, for years. And I imagine at some point, you know, even after all these years, he'll eventually make it into a story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I brought this up, is I'm thinking that there's probably no better training for a writer than to sort of live in the world. And I talked to a lot of writers who, you know, they were writers out of the birth canal, and they, you know, they were on this path and they were English majors and they went on for their MFA straight from there. And I keep thinking about just the value of these experiences and, you know, living a lot of different lives before you settle into writing, and the richness and sort of, you know, depth of character and these observations and dialogue, all that stuff that would be added to your writing from those experiences. I don't know if you feel that way.
Oh, sure. I mean, I left home at 18. I left Texas at 18, sort of tumbled out into the big wide world with, you know, almost no money and almost no experience. And went from Texas to Venice Beach, California, actually, and got a job waiting tables. In fact, recently I was asked how many years I'd spent waiting tables, and I had to actually sit down and do the math. And I think a grand total of about 12 or 13 years waiting tables. I put myself through, you know, a degree doing that. For me, the journey was really circuitous, and I think probably I would not be a writer at all had I not had those experiences. I was one of the first of my family to go to college, and began my college career by taking one or two classes at Santa Monica Community College while I waited tables and learned to surf and saw a bit of the world and had adventures. And then finished up my college career in Flagstaff, Arizona, at Northern Arizona University, doing much the same thing, taking a few classes as I could afford them and waiting tables and exploring that beautiful region. I think when you grow up in a place as sort of flat and brown as West Texas, it can be thrilling to experience beautiful places, you know, natural beauty. And so I spent a lot of time hiking and camping and driving and exploring and backpacking, and waiting tables and doing my work study job. My job in Flagstaff as a classical music announcer was my work study position. So I was able to do the late shift. I think it was from 10 to 2 or something like that. For me, living a bit of life was absolutely crucial to becoming a writer. And I've talked with people a lot about going to the Iowa Writers Workshop. And one of the things I've realized as time has passed is that for me, actually, the Writers Workshop was the Iowa Writers Workshop was more of a an anomaly rather than just sort of the normal trajectory of my life. Finding myself in that place with that group of people for those 2 years felt very odd to me. It was unlike any sort of experience I'd ever had, and honestly, really different from my life before or, frankly, my life since.
I want to unpack that a little bit. So you had been writing for a period of time before you applied to Iowa. Did that come up fairly early in your writing career?
Yeah, I think I let's see if I can remember correctly. I think I wrote my first short story, you know, 25, 26, and I did not go to the workshop until I was about 32. So
okay. So great. That
and in fact, I was dressed and walking out the door to my waitressing shift when I got the call from Connie Brothers at the Iowa Writers Workshop. And the reason she called rather than sending a letter was that she called to say they very much wanted to admit me, but I had filled out all my paperwork incorrectly. So I had not sent my college transcripts. And who knows why, I probably still owed money to the library or something. I mean, but I was actually literally walking out the door when I heard the phone ring, and I turned around and went back in and answered the phone. It was very much out of step with the life I had led to that point, and in a lot of ways, the life I've led since.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the, I want to dive into the book, but there's some wonderful waitressing scenes, I will just say, in this novel, and you certainly have captured the waitressing life so well in this book. So let's dive into the book. I'm going to let you introduce it for people who haven't yet picked it up. And, I'll tell you, I've been pressing this into everybody's hands that, you know, everybody always asks for book recommendations, and this is my top one. So, but for those who have not yet read it, kind of take us into this world and talk a little bit about these women and set the stage for us.
So Valentine is set in 1976 in the oil patch city of Odessa, Texas, which is the town where I grew up. And it explores the aftermath of a vicious crime, a violent rape against a 14-year-old Mexican-American girl, and the lingering effects it has on her and her family, as well as the other women and girls in town. And I've told the story through the voices of seven characters, among them Corinne Shepherd, an old woman who thinks that she's made all the big decisions she's going to make in her life and who is deeply grieving over her husband who's recently died, and Deborah Ann Pierce, a young girl whose mother has left town without her, and Mary Rose Whitehead, a young mother and the wife of a cattle rancher who is the first person to open the door to try to help this young woman who's experienced this crime. And then, of course, the young woman who begins the book, Glory Ramirez, who is the victim of this terrible crime and who really struggles to heal from that crime over the course of the book and to not let that one sort of terrible moment define the rest of her life.
What was the entry point for you? I feel like I read someplace that this started with a short story, but was it one of these characters? Was it the situation? Kind of where, you know, way back when you had the kernel of the idea, how did it start for you?
You know, I promise I'm not being coy when I say this, but it's difficult to even remember a single spark. I suppose, honestly, the single spark for the book came from the stories I spent much of my childhood listening to as I sat out on the back porch after supper, listening to my mom and the women in the neighborhood and her girlfriends talk about their lives, their children, their families, what was going on in town. You know, during oil booms, I listened to them talk about who had gotten a new job and who had bought a new house and how good things were going financially. But I also listened to them talk about the precipitous rise in traffic or the impossible housing prices or, you know, the steep increase in crime that seems to always accompany an oil boom in towns like that. And then during oil bust, I listened to them talk about whose house had been foreclosed on, who had lost their jobs. There's a sort of local sort of saying in towns like Odessa that during the oil bust, the only industry that makes any money is the U-Haul service. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. So I was a strange kid who sort of spent a lot of time eavesdropping. Harriet the Spy was probably one of my favorite books when I was a kid. And I spent a lot of time eavesdropping on the adults in my life. And so honestly, I think in a lot of ways, the first spark were those voices of those women and girls girls that I knew growing up. And of course, the characters are fiction. They're amalgamation. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, I've been talking a lot the last few days.
I get it. No worries.
That's why I'm drinking hot tea like nobody's business. But you know, so those were probably the first sparks of the short story that became the book that became Valentine. excuse me.
No worries.
So all those voices, there's a kind of lyricism to a West Texas accent that I've always really loved. Well, that's not true. I guess I didn't always love it. I think when I was a young woman, I didn't love it. But as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate the kind of musicality of speech from that part of the world. It's an accent actually that's starting to disappear as Texas changes in ways that are, you know, both wonderful and deeply troubling, depending on, you know, what change you're talking about. But one of the changes is that it's become a lot more urban state. And one of the things that's happening is that West Texas accent is becoming less and less common in people under the age of 40. And so there's a kind of lyricism to that I really fell in love with. Just as a simple example, having a character ask how come, right, rather than why. And so those were the sparks. I'm always interested in the way a book sounds. I read a lot of poetry in addition to fiction. And so those were the sparks, I guess, initially. But after that, you know, I read a lot of newspapers from the local area. I did a lot of research. I still have family in that part of the world. And so I made sure when I went home for visits to spend a lot of time driving around in the oil patch by myself, looking at the landscape and the oil derricks and, you know, hanging out in town. So.
Was that original story? It gives nothing away to say that there's a rape at the very beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And was that the source of the original short story that you wrote?
No, the original short story began in that second chapter with Mary Rose Whitehead, and this young woman coming to her door.
Okay.
Glory's story, the first chapter, came later. And actually, when I published this as a short story, I had already, by the time I published it as a short story, I had already gotten Glory's story in there. And so it appears in the published version of the short story. But Mary Rose was really where it began for me. What happened in the process of writing that story was I understood that I could not write this book without tackling head on, or at least attempting to tackle head on, the terrible racism that I witnessed growing up. Mm-hmm. And the racism that lingers in that region to this day. Mm-hmm. And so once I made that decision that I was going to try to tackle this head on, it was very clear to me that I should start by saying that I really struggled with whether or not to have this crime happen to a young Mexican American girl as opposed to one of the white girls in town. And once I made that decision, I understood very clearly that I could not have her story filtered solely through the voices of white women and girls. And I really wrestled with what it meant to ask a reader to witness this kind of suffering. And some of the, I guess, dangers that lay in that choosing to have this happen to a Mexican American girl. So
it's so interesting because I talk to a lot of writers about the world the book was born into. And I know you've been writing this book for a really long time. I mean, I think you said 14 or 15 years. And yet the world the book is born into feels, I mean, it's always been relevant. It feels no more relevant than ever in the past 3 or 4 years. And I always think that's kind of an interesting thing when sort of the stars align and the book is speaking to something much bigger than the time frame it was set into. And I don't know if you find that gratifying or disheartening, but it seems like the right book for the right time.
Yeah, both gratifying and disheartening. And yeah, I did work on the book for about 14 years now. To be fair, I wrote a lot of other things as I was working on this book, and I took long breaks from the book, either because life took me away, working, raising my son, or frankly, because I lost my nerve. This book was so important to me from the beginning, and it was so important to me to get it right, that I often had to step away from it. I mean, that it came out when it did, is both, you know, gratifying and disheartening. But the truth is that, you know, in the days that the news story, for example, first started to break about the terrible, you know, the separations of families down at the border, you know, I heard a lot of talk from my friends here in Chicago, a kind of, you know, just astonishment that such a terrible thing could be happening in that part of the world. And I remember saying and thinking, you know, it can be easy to treat what's going on at the border now as if it's something new. But in fact, any of us who grew up in a place like Texas know that that region has always been troubled. You know, the history, you cannot talk about the history of Texas, honestly, without talking about the history of what was done to Mexican Americans and Mexicans who lived in Texas. You know, wide scale lynchings, for example, bigotry and prejudice, discrimination that continues to this day.
My guest this morning is Elizabeth Wetmore. The book we are talking about is Valentine, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I had mentioned to you before that the novel almost has this kind of feeling of a collection of linked short stories. I mean, obviously, there's an obvious through line and there's an obvious global narrative, but each of these women really have their own story, their own backstory, their own history, which is all relevant to the women they become and how they tell the story. But I was wondering if I think when you're a kind of a natural short story writer, the idea of tackling a novel feels so overwhelming. And a lot of writers that have made that jump tell me that they do it by sort of thinking about the novel as chunks of short stories. And I was just wondering if you know, in putting together the bigger work, you kind of thought of it that way as you're putting these women's individual stories together.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the short story is the form I most love and the form I'm most comfortable with. And when I decided when I realized really more than anything else that these women's stories were linked, you know, and that a lot of these characters were the same women from story to story or chapter to chapter. For example, there's a chapter early in the book. I think it's the only other chapter that was also published as a short story. And it's Jenny's story, Deborah Ann's mom. Mm. And the story is set on the day she's leaving town, and really leaving her daughter behind to go in search of a bigger life, I guess. I did not realize that she was Deborah Ann's mom when I was writing the short story. By the time I put that chapter in the novel, I already knew her daughter, and I knew her very well. And so it changed the way I treated that story when it became a chapter. But for me, I guess the thing that sort of inspired me more than anything else to make it a novel was, for all my love of the short story, I feel like one of the advantages of the novel is it gives you maybe a little more time and space to really explore an idea. Or a set of ideas. And while, of course, these ideas weren't in my head as I was working on the first or second or third or fourth drafts, at some point in the process, I did become interested in exploring some ideas. For example, the question of what do we do when a stranger comes to our front door seeking help? Mm-hmm. You know, which in a lot of ways, I think may be one of the most important questions any of us answers in our lives, whether it's a young woman who's just been a victim of a terrible crime, or whether the stranger who comes to our door is a family of immigrants seeking a better life, you know. So that was something that was of interest to me. I found myself very interested in the question of of courage and acting in heroic ways, even if you don't see yourself as a hero. I'm very interested in these characters because these are by and large women without a lot of education, mm-hmm. without a lot of options, without a lot of money. They're women who have not always been on the right side of things. And yet they find a way within the constraints of their world to lift themselves up and to lift each other up and to act in ways that are heroic. And even if they're in very quiet ways. And so I was really interested in this idea that no matter who we are, where we're from, you know, when the situation calls for it, it's possible to, you know, we have the ability to step up, you know, and act in ways that are courageous.
The other, that's so profound. And now I'm going to ask a mundane question. So I feel, I feel bad about leaving it on that note. But the other thing that struck me of organizing it like this as sort of a, you know, short story feel is that you get all of this latitude in point of view. So a lot of these, you know, some chapters are told from first person present, others are told from third person past. There's even a collective we, you know, Greek chorus sort of chapter. And that freedom, I think, to come at this not only from a bunch of different characters' points of view, but a first person, third person, present, past point of view really also lent a lot of power to it. And I don't know if you felt more comfortable in one, you know, if it was very obvious that Mary Rose was always going to be a first person character, whereas the others would be mostly third. But I'd love for you to just talk to that point about being able to play around with tenses and POVs.
You know, I make these decisions intuitively, and I generally will experiment quite a bit. So, for example, part of my process always when I'm writing a short story, for example, is I will begin a short story in the point of view and the tense that that makes the most sense to me in that moment, whatever I'm feeling. But very early in the process, usually sometime between the moment I realize I've got something worth keeping and that it's not going to be abandoned and shoved in a drawer for a little while I let it percolate. And when I finally make the commitment to point of view and tense, I will open a new file and just start retyping the story. And I'll type it from second person present, and I'll retype it a third time from, you know, third person omniscient, and third person present and third person past. It's an excruciatingly slow process.
Cool.
And if you can avoid it, I don't recommend it. But for me, it works. and of course, the other thing I'm always doing is I read aloud constantly. I will never be one of those writers who's sort of, you know, holed up in the corner of a coffee shop writing, you know, the great American novel or whatever, because I have to sit quietly in my room alone. And part of the reason for that is I read aloud constantly.
That's
so
helpful.
I really
helpful.
Do make these decisions based on what sounds right and what feels right.
Tell me a little bit about mining some of these characters, because their backstory is what brings such depth and texture to a lot of these women. And some of it, you know, when you finish the novel, you're like, did I need to know all that? And then when you finish, you're like, yeah, I did. I needed to know all of that. I needed to know what made these women tick. And so I'm just curious about your process of if you kept kind of notebooks and you had pictures of these women on your desk, or if you had, you know, timelines on your wall of each of these women's lives and where they came from, or kind of talk about your process of understanding who these women were.
I did all of those things. I had pictures. I had a picture that I found online of a woman, and I knew immediately that was my Corinne Shepherd. You know, I read a lot of local newspapers, and of course there were the women I knew growing up. For me, I'm 52, and this is my debut book. And one of the questions that's come up with some frequency has been a more polite version of what took you so long? and what took me so long was that I thought when I left home that I knew these women and girls, that I understood who they were. And it turns out that I did not know them at all. And what I learned when I started working on this book was that growing up in a place, you know, doesn't mean understanding it or seeing it clearly. And hearing these stories and these having these voices of these women and girls doesn't mean really understanding them. So on some level, I think I just had to get older. but I also think that, you know, it took me a while to be able to look back on the place where I grew up and the people I grew up with and see them with the kind of love, frankly, that they deserved to be, the, you know, the kind of lens of love that they deserved to be viewed through for all their faults and failings. I read somewhere that a novel is a love letter, you know, and some people say it's a love letter to the reader or a love letter to, you know, an idea. For me, Valentine is a love letter to the place where I grew up and the people I knew growing up there. And it took me a long time to be able to write that love letter.
I have this conversation with a lot of writers about how many writers there are that return to the place of their origin to write about. And I do think there's something so powerful about growing up in a place before you have language to describe it. And so it kind of works its way into your bones in a different way that's not filtered through language, but is filtered through the sensory, you know, life of living there and the landscape and the smells and all of that stuff. And I always wonder if that is one of the reasons that writers are always called back to the place where they grew up and then can write about it, as you say, as like a love letter to that place, because they understand it so viscerally and pre-language, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
For me, I mean, it began with falling back in love with the land and that epic sky, you know, honestly. I mean, I've mentioned that, you know, I still have family there, I think I mentioned that. And so I go back as often as I'm able. And every time I go back, well, I love to take long drives in general. And that's something that my life here in Chicago doesn't really lend itself to. So when I return home, I've always gone for really long drives in the oil patch. And I think I fell in love with the land outside my hometown. And that was kind of my entry into falling back in love with the place where I grew up.
Well, I'll say I have never been to Texas, and there is such a language in your book, like it, whether it's the animals that are there or obviously the drilling rigs and their pump jacks. I mean, I'd never even heard of the word pump jack, but I knew it intuitively, obviously, when you said it. And all of these, you know, it's almost as though the state has its own, not only its own dialect, but its own language of understanding the landscape. And that, you know, just seeped through these pages so well. It was, you know, really like, especially in these times of quarantine when we're all locked in the same rooms all day, a really great opportunity to get to travel someplace that I've never been. So that was really fun too. What was my next question? I had so many. I have so many. Tell me a little bit about the character that may have been the most difficult to access. I could guess, but I'll let you talk about who was kind of the most difficult to get into and your process for mining her.
Well, I struggled with all of them in their different ways. I'm a terribly slow writer, and my first instincts are not always my best instincts, and I revise constantly and endlessly. I mean, I'll be honest with you, if I had the opportunity to fetch this book back right now, there are some paragraphs I would remove. There are some choices I would make differently. I mean, it's some, you know, when people talk about when is it over, I mean, for me, it was over when my editor finally wrestled it out of my hands and sent a very polite email saying we were going to press, you know. So I revise endlessly, and all of the characters are difficult in their own ways. Some of them in surprising ways. I have a character who shows up kind of late, Suzanne, who I found to be very difficult to write because she's so different from me. She's a woman who very much sort of toes the line, you know, and that has not been my experience. But the character who was truly the most difficult to write was Glory Ramirez. And of course, I've talked a little bit about, you know, interrogating my choice to make her a young woman of Mexican American heritage. I was keenly aware from the get-go that that I had a responsibility to try to educate myself as best I could, to talk about her story and in ways that were meaningful and also accorded her the dignity and the depth of story that she and her family deserved. And so I asked a lot of questions of some people I grew up with. For example, I made the decision somewhat early in the book that she would not be she would not speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. And that was a tricky decision, in part because her mother is an undocumented worker in this book. And so, and I came to that by talking with some friends of mine that I'd grown up with who told me that, you know, back then, and I think to a lesser degree today, but it was very common for children of immigrants to their parents not to want them to speak Spanish at all. You know, there was a lot of discrimination in school. Kids weren't allowed to speak Spanish in schools in Texas in the 70s, or at least in my part of Texas. I feel like I should always qualify that because West Texas is such a distinct sort of not just landscape, but sort of cultural, you know, part of Texas. It's really its own thing. So those were some of the work I did. I ran passages past friends and asked them to take a look at them for me. And I also, at some level, I made my peace with the idea that I might not get it exactly right. And there it was. I kind of decided to go for it and hope that I was able to try to do the best I could to get it right and make my peace with the idea that I might not.
You know, it's funny, early in the interview, you said something about the original choice, thinking that she might be a white young woman who was raped. And that choice would, you know, have just changed the novel profoundly. I mean, it just wouldn't have been the same book whatsoever. And that choice just seemed so absolutely necessary. And, you know, as we're having all of these discussions now about who is able to tell whose story, mm-hmm. You know, I come back to the idea that if we can't inhabit the other in a very empathetic, respectful, aching to get it right as much as we can and vetting it with as many people as we can way, you know, we're just going to take the center out of writing, I think, if we're not allowed to make that empathetic leap into another person's point of view. How can we know we get anybody right? Right. But I know that's a tricky choice, but it certainly was a necessary choice.
Well, for sure, because one of the things that I was really keenly aware of was that, you know, this young woman, even if I had made her white, she still probably would not have gotten any justice in the legal system. But I knew that justice was going to be, you know, a near impossibility if I made her a young woman of Mexican American ancestry. And so I wouldn't say I was playing a trick on the reader, but I was very interested at some point in wondering how different readers would come to this book. You know, I wanted the kind of I wanted the sort of hopelessness of Mary Rose's quest to be apparent. And then, of course, once I made the decision that this crime was happening to a young woman who is Mexican American, then I understood nearly immediately that having made that choice, I could not simply allow her story to be told through the voices and perspectives of white women, right? Which meant that then once I made that choice, she had to have a point of view in the story.
I worked
hard not to have her be saved by, you know, the white women in the book. I mean, on the one hand, I think you can make the argument that Mary Rose opening that door to this young woman on her porch is a tremendous act of courage. I think another way of looking at that is that it was the bare minimum in the moment.
Right. Yes.
I mean, the real hero of this book is Glory, who saves herself. you know, and, you know, from the opening pages, when she stands up and walks away, you know, she is saving herself. And that was, and so after I made that decision, it was also somewhat important to me to not have the worlds overlap much. You know, after that moment, there's never another moment where Mary Rose and Glory have another conversation. And so it was important to me to begin and end the book with Glory.
Yes. Yes, yes. You know, this might be, I had mentioned to you that there's a passage in this book that it has just blown me away over and over, and I've probably read it 5 times, and I've typed it out for myself to just feel what the words feel like when you type them out. And so I thought maybe this would be a good time to have you read that. It's towards the end of the book, but I don't think it gives a lot away, but it does speak to a lot of these issues that we're talking about right now. Do you mind reading that little section we talked about?
No, not at all. Where would you like me to start? At the beginning of that section?
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you do that? Start at the beginning. Yeah.
Okay. And I will read to the bottom of page 252. Like, does that work for you?
Yeah. On the way out the door would be the perfect.
Okay, perfect, great.
Yeah, great.
Corinne is an unrepentant leadfoot, accustomed to going at least 20 miles over the speed limit, even when she's in no particular hurry. Now she drives down the I-20 like death itself is chasing her. The speedometer's needle trembles between 80 and 85 miles an hour, but Mary Rose's white sedan is moving faster, and the distance between the two cars grows until the younger woman is at least half a mile ahead. With the storm moving south at 10 miles an hour, the women drive into a cloud of red dirt and bone-colored caliche dust. As they approach Penwell, the wind turns fierce and Corinne's car begins to shake. The motion roils her stomach, reminding her that she has not eaten today, that she is thirsty, that she drank too much last night and every night since Potter died, that she is an old woman completely unprepared to stop the world from coming apart at the seams. When they were standing in Corinne's driveway and Mary Rose spat out that word, bastard, her voice was flat as the land Corinne is looking at now, and her heart fell to her feet. She has heard this tone of voice a few times in her life, usually, but not always, from a man or group of men. And although Mary Rose is angry and afraid, and there's a little girl driving around with a man they don't know, it occurs to Corinne why Mary Rose's tone of voice sounds so familiar. It is not the ginned-up, high-pitched rage you hear when a crowd burns a book or throws a rock through a window or plants a kerosene-soaked cross in somebody's yard and sets it ablaze. The flatness of Mary Rose's speech, the hollow effect, the cold and steady tone of her voice, all are fear and rage transformed into wrath. Hers is the voice of someone whose mind is made up. All that's left to do is wait for the little spark that will justify what is about to happen next. All her life, Corinne has watched this poison move through her students and their parents, through men sitting at the bar or in the bleachers, through churchgoers and neighbors and the town's fathers and mothers. She has watched her own kith and kin pour this poison into their best glassware, spoon it onto the plates and bowls their ancestors hauled in wagons from Georgia and Alabama, all while proclaiming that they worked for everything they ever got and nobody ever gave them nothing. They earned it, living and dying in that refinery, in those fields, and they can't do a goddamn thing about the people who control the purse strings and hand over their paychecks, who can put them out of work with a wink and a nod, but they can sure point a finger at somebody else. If they say it long enough, in enough different ways, they might stop seeing the child of God standing on the other side of those words or buckling under the awful weight of them. Whatever gets you through the night or helps you turn your back so you can keep up the lie, whatever lets you light the match or throw the rope over a strong branch and still be home in time for dinner and the football game. And while Mary Rose has maybe has better reason than most of these fools and sinners to open the door for unbridled wrath, Corinne also knows this. One way or another, it will eventually kill you. But goddamn, you can do some damage on your way out the door.
Mm. That was Elizabeth Wetmore reading from Valentine, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I just feel like that passage says so much about where we are today, where we've always been maybe, and where we are now. And it, as I was telling my husband, I read that to him and I was like, that, you know, this is what fiction can do that, that all the articles and nonfiction can't do. It just, you know, makes you feel where we are. So that's just incredible. I want to ask about one of the choices you made, which is to not use quotation marks with dialogue. And I know I was looking at your Facebook wall, somebody else had asked that. And I think the power of what grammar can do and not do when rules are sort of broken or bent or however they are, can add so much to a narrative. And I was saying the first time I encountered this was with Jose Saramago's Blindness, when he didn't use quotation marks, and how effective it was. So I just wanted you to talk about that decision and what it did for the narrative and kind of how it advanced the depth and texture of the book.
Yeah, Blindness is a beautiful book. I think I may be first encountered it in the book Plain Song by Kent Hiruf, which is one of my favorites. You know, it's funny to me, people seem to have really strong opinions
about on everything. Yeah, right.
I've been a little surprised by the strong opinions about the use of or the lack thereof of quotation marks. I find it a little surprising. I guess every writer makes her own choices and has her own quirks. I've never loved the way quotation marks look on the page, to be honest with you. I almost wish we did it the British way with just the single quotation mark, because it seems a little less intrusive. And I'm not committed to never using quotation marks, but for this book, they felt wrong to me from the get-go, honestly. The book is, Valentine is so voice heavy, and the language is such a crucial part of the book that I really balked at sort of pulling the reader's attention away from that to basically say, look, here's dialogue.
Yes, right.
And so for me, it was very much an aesthetic choice, and one that I might make differently for another book. In fact, I actually have a couple of short stories that I did use quotation marks in, and I was fine with it. But for this book, it was really kind of an instinctive choice. It was a very early choice. I knew from the get-go that I wouldn't be using them. And it really had as much to do with looking at the words on the page, and feeling as if quotation marks were an intrusion on sort of the movement and the lyricism of the language.
It's really interesting you should say that, because your mention of poetry and how much you read poetry and how much you read aloud, and the aesthetic choice, I totally connect with. The other thing I thought that it did for me is that these women were so interior and of their, I don't know, of their mind and of the, and inside their body, that it was a really nice way for me to show that it almost didn't matter what was said out loud and what was being, you know, kind of felt and thought in their head, that was a way, it was obvious when they were talking to somebody. So it wasn't work. But it also was a really nice way for me to show that they were, mostly, I don't know, kind of prisoners within themselves in some way, and prisoners a bit of their gender. There was a great passage in here when you talked about, girls being given a cheerleading outfit when they were still in diapers, and that their job was to sort of cheer men on. And for me, I thought the lack of quotation marks, not women not quite having a voice, it kind of showed that, and then it showed sort of how trapped inside themselves they were. And I just thought it was really beautiful.
I think that's such a great observation and really spot on. You know, one of the things that I thought about a lot when I was writing this book, and it actually took me probably longer than it should have to realize this, maybe even after I became a mom myself, but one of the things that I thought about a lot as I was writing this book is how terribly young so many of these women are. You know, Mary Rose Whitehead is 26 years old when this book opens. She has a 9-year-old daughter, you know. Jenny Pierce, you know, who is leaving home, is, I think she's 25. She has a 10-year-old daughter, you know. And these women are so very young. And I think in that quote that you were talking about, I think one of the things that happens in there is, Mary Rose says, you know, how could I even know, right? How could I even know what love is? How could I even know anything? My whole life, right, has been about being, you know, a girl in this world, right? And taught to sort of, you know, hold up the men at all cost and first and foremost. And then her life as a mother at a very young age. So.
Right, right. And it was a way to, as the, I think the back of the book jacket or something makes this point about it, it's sort of a way for women to reclaim these stories that were always in the domain of men and, you know, to find their voice through talking to each other. And again, I thought the lack of quotation marks really, you know, set that off, that they've lacked a voice, but they're finding their voice. And I just thought it was a really great, great choice. We should spend our last few minutes talking about sort of what you learned along the way, writing advice or things that you got from Iowa or some of the, I know you had a long laundry list of really wonderful professors that you worked with. And some of the things that you found the most useful or the most sustaining, especially through the many years and many drafts of this book, you know, things that could be useful for writers.
Yeah, I've learned a great deal from every teacher I ever studied with. And I've learned just as much from the books I've read, you know, fiction, poetry, nonfiction. And I've learned just as much from the life I lived, you know, before I began writing Valentine and the life I lived as I was writing it. You know, in a lot of ways, I think that the single most important thing that happened to me in the writing of Valentine, not all of my work, but in the writing of Valentine, was having my son. I think that having my son allowed me finally to be able to look at these women's lives with so much more empathy and compassion and understanding, clarity, that I simply just did not have before I became a mom myself. You know, from my teachers, from Chris Offit, who was my first teacher at Iowa, I was introduced to the work of Bryce DJ Pancake, whose stories are set in West Virginia mining towns. And Chris was probably one of the first teachers who really made me see that the stuff of ordinary lives, the stuff of quiet lives is the stuff of fiction and art and philosophy. From all of these writers, Marilyn Robinson and Luis Orea, I learned, you know, the value of according dignity to your characters, no matter who they are, and the tenderness with which all of those writers, Chris and Marilyn and Luis, you know, treat their characters. There's just a kind of tenderness in all of their work that I really admire and aspire to. And then I guess I've learned, you know, through my own life and from teachers as well, you know, the importance of not giving up, honestly, or not, you know, of understanding that, you know, we all are on our own trajectory. I good for people who sort of, you know, graduate from high school, go to college, go to their MFA program, get their first book deal. That's wonderful for them. That was not my story, and it couldn't have been. I really very much needed to live a fair amount of life before I was ready to start writing fiction. And of course, you know, for me, I'm the first of my family to go to college. Earning a living has always been, you know, a daily concern. My husband is a high school English teacher and a poet.
So, I love it.
So yeah. So we, you know, we have a house full of adults who, you know, are never going to make a ton of money, you know. And so for us, you know, we always had to pay the bills. And there are a lot of writers like that, you know. I mean, they have to pay the bills. They have to care for elderly parents. They're caring for children. And I think it can be very easy to, you know, hit 30 and, you know, not have your book finished, and hit 35 and hit 40 and to at some point say to yourself, you know, this dream is over, this door is closed, you know, it's time to move along to the business of living with, you know, without dreaming of being a writer or writing a good book. And I guess for me, you know, the biggest lessons I've learned are, you know, keep going and ask for help, honestly. I mean, this book would not exist without those grants that you talked about at the beginning when you were doing my biography. Mm-hmm. You know, the the NEA grant came when my son was 2 years old. And every bit of that grant went to childcare. Now, I worked on other things that year as well. I didn't just work on Valentine. I was writing some short stories and some essays about motherhood that went into a drawer and have stayed there. But without that grant, this book would not exist. Without the residencies that allowed me to go to, you know, a beautiful part of New Hampshire for 4 weeks and hole up in a cabin and walk and write, you know, and walk in the woods, and sort of be away from my daily life, this book would not exist. So I asked for a lot of help along the way too. And, you know, I think that's hard for any of us. I grew up in a place, you know, surrounded by people who would rather die than ask for help.
Right.
And so for me, that was very hard, you know, but I, you know, my husband, and honestly, the book is finished now, honestly, in as much as any other reason, because for the last few years, my husband took on a second job so that I could take on as little freelance work as possible and devote myself to finishing up the book. So for several years, you know, he taught high school English all day and then, you know, went and did private tutoring at night so that I could just take on just, you know, as little freelance as I could and devote myself to the book. I mean, asking for help was probably the hardest lesson I had to learn.
That's fantastic. Well, one thing I will say about coming to writing later, and I don't even consider 52 later.
But, yeah, me either.
that aside, I mean, writing is one of those great and few careers, you know, unlike playing football or something, that you just get better and better. You know, like an aging wine, the more life experience you accumulate, just the better it's your writing is going to be. And so I think you're clearly just getting started with this, and you have to write the next one really fast so we can do this again, because this was just so wonderful.
Thankfully, I have a lot of things in the drawer, so including actually the sort of follow up to Valentine. So,
oh, fantastic!
Yeah, it's going to be set in 1982 in Odessa, and it will begin at the sort of peak of the oil boom and end a few months after the terrible crash.
Fantastic! So, were your parents in the oil industry?
My dad worked in the petrochemical plant outside of town for 30 years. Wow. And my mom, she worked raising us kids, but she also worked as receptionist at Bering Supply Companies. And my mom and dad were very much sort of, you know, they came from pretty, they came from really, really modest backgrounds. And so for them, you know, sort of working their way into the middle class was their sort of their dream for my sister and me. I mean, practically every man in my family worked in the oil patch at one time or another.
Amazing.
And I think a lot of times, you know, when people think of the oil and gas industry, particularly people who aren't from that part of the world, you know, the image that comes to mind are of these, you know, big oil executives. And I think, you know, what is sometimes lost in our conversations are the lives of the working men and women who you know, cobble together a living and keep a roof over their head by virtue of what is hard and dangerous and unreliable work, you know.
Indeed. Well, you gave justice to their stories. This was really, really wonderful. Elizabeth Wetmore, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.